Welcome to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline. I'm your host, Monica Hadley, and our guest today is Dr. Linda Eckert, who is a professor of obstetrics and gynecology with an infectious disease fellowship at the University of Washington and an internationally recognized expert in immunizations and cervical cancer prevention. For over 30 years, Dr. Eckert has worked at Seattle's Harborview Hospital, treating people from all around the world, frequently in the spotlight for her expertise in HPV vaccinations and cervical cancer screenings. Dr. Eckert is passionate in her drive to eliminate this deadly disease, and so passionate that she spent, I think, 3 years writing this book, Enough, Because We Can Stop Cervical Cancer. Welcome to Writers' Voices. Should I call you Linda or Dr. Eckert?
No, call me Linda. Okay. Yeah, I really appreciate the chance to be here. Thank you.
Great. So what made you decide to write this book?
That's a good question. A lot of things. But I'd say the overwhelming feeling was just anger. Anger at watching so many women that I cared for or known of die from a preventable cancer, and the impact that has on their families. And even if they don't die, the impact the treatment has on their bodies. And I just felt like if people understood this disease and knew more about it and knew how preventable it was, then I would hope we could change the narrative.
You must be even angrier right now.
I am doing a lot of exercise and meditation right now, yes.
It must be so, so frustrating to see the direction that our country is headed in regards to vaccinations by putting somebody in charge of the Department of, is it the Department of Health? Is that what it's called?
Or security, but his remit is so large, right? There are several agencies underneath that, including the CDC.
Yeah, that is totally anti-vaccine, and it's so distressing.
There's a lot of, I'm trying to hold perspective and stay grounded because I think public health has always been it can always be from the ground up and not just the top down. So I think it's really important that we don't lose our voice and that we don't lose our focus with all of the overwhelm around us. That said, yes, it's been really hard. I've spent decades of my career working with wonderful professionals who are funded by PEPFAR and USAID to do screening in Africa and programs that, we spent a decade or more gearing up, got shut down in 2 weeks. So I think the global impact of this is quite large, not just the United States impact. And I'm just hoping that the messaging in our country can stay positive about preventing a cancer, either by screening or with a vaccination.
So cervical cancer, when was it discovered that it was caused usually, not always, but usually by the HPV virus?
Yeah, so the actual discoveries were in the early 90s, late 80s, actually, and the person who discovered that got a Nobel Prize for it. Zurhausen is his name. But when I started my training and even my faculty time, I started on faculty in 1991. I remember hearing lectures that, cervical cancer still could be related to herpes, or maybe it's related to chlamydia. We just didn't really understand. And so it really has something that's evolved over my career lifetime, which is pretty remarkable considering you go from finding the etiology of it to a vaccination that can prevent almost all of the HPV-associated cancers in this short of its time frame is actually an incredible, remarkable thing.
And cervical cancer is not the only cancer that can be caused by HPV, although it is by far the majority.
Yeah, and thank you for bringing that up, because I think that's a well-kept secret, that There actually are six cancers caused by human papillomavirus, and including throat cancer, which in our country right now, throat cancer is actually killing more individuals than cervical cancer because we don't have the equivalent of a pap smear or screening for the throat cancers. And that's an area of research, but the currently, often it's found in a higher stage, and it's more commonly in men. And that's one of the reasons why vaccinating males and females for the HPV virus is a really good decision. But I think a lot of people don't realize that 70% of throat cancer is caused by HPV 16. I think the other cancers are penile, anal, vulvar, and vaginal. And then cervical, which is depending on studies, 95 to 98% HPV caused.
Are there other viruses that cause cancers?
Yeah, there are. Hepatitis B virus causes liver cancer, and it's interesting that we vaccinated against hepatitis B in infancy. Most people don't realize they're actually vaccinating against a sexually transmitted infection that can cause cancer, but they are. And then Epstein-Barr virus is another virus that can lead to cancers. But HPV is by far the most common because, 80% of adults will have an HPV infection at some point in their lives. It's just a marker essentially of intimate contact. And so the good news is it gets rid of itself most of the time. Our body clears it, but it isn't the only cancer causes of virus.
So that was something that was new to me when I read your book, that your body you usually will eliminate HPV. Why sometimes it does and sometimes it doesn't?
Isn't that a good question? And sometimes it's because of immune status. We certainly understand in people that have to take immune suppression because they have an organ transplant, or in individuals impacted by HIV disease, that it's much harder for our body to get rid of the human papillomavirus. But most of the time, 80% of the time, our bodies will get rid of it within 80 to 90% of the time, within a couple of years, which is really good news given how common it is.
Yeah, it's just like some of the people that you talk about in your book, which I want to mention that this book, it goes into the science, the medicine and so forth, but it really goes into the human element of this. And you have a number of women who are speaking to you, speaking out, sharing their story. And quite a few of them seem to be really healthy before they got diagnosed with cervical cancer. And we
I
just
think
have no idea why they weren't able to deal with it.
we don't have a good answers for that. It's not like there's specific genetic risks like with breast cancer or ovarian cancer that we've identified. And so certainly smoking contributes. It's harder to clear the HPV virus if you smoke. But that's really the single behavior that I think you can control besides doing the active things that you can to prevent getting it or to follow up if you do have it and make sure your body is getting rid of it.
Now, the other thing that I learned that I didn't know before is that there are a number of variants of HPV, and that some of them are a lot worse than others.
HPV is identified, the type of HPV is identified by the surface, the proteins on the surface and their structure. And we actually know of at least 150 types of HPV. And of those 150 types, about 40 to 50 can impact the genital tract. But of those that impact the genital tract, there's 12 that can cause precancer changes, and those are called the high-risk HPV types. And those are the types that we test for when we do HPV screening to look for risk of precancer. And even among those 12 types, they're not all created equal. There's one type, HPV 16, that is by and far the most dangerous type for leading to precancer and cancer. And it causes over 50% of cervical cancer, and like I mentioned previously, over 70% of throat cancer, almost all of the anal cancer. So HPV 16 is the type that has the most risk of turning into precancer or cancer, followed by HPV 18, which is the second most common cancer-causing type. But it's
So
those 12 types that we test for when we test for high-risk HPV.
let's talk about the screening methods that are used. So, as a woman who's been on this planet for a while, I've known about Pap smears for a long time, and that was pretty much the only screening method for a long time, right?
Yes, it was. Pap smears became widespread used in the early 70s in our country. And what essentially a Pap smear is a collection of the cells that are on the surface of the cervix or on the inside lining of the cervix. And then you look at them under the microscope and you look to see if there's any changes that might indicate precancer in or cancer. And if there are, then you take a closer look, usually with what we call a colposcopy, which is like a microscope-assisted look, and you biopsy areas that look abnormal, and then you can tell for sure under the microscope, what is wrong with those cells, if there's anything wrong with the cells, and then you move to treatment if there is of the precancer. So that is very effective screening if you can do it for the whole population, and if you have the access to either get the Pap smear or then to get the follow-up if you have an abnormal result and to get the treatment. And that was the bedrock of our screening program for decades, and it definitely lowered cervical cancer rates here and anywhere where it could be used. More recently, we've started screening for HPV virus itself. And that is a test of just a cotton swab that's placed in the vagina or on the cervix. And that swab is then tested for these 12 high-risk types. Some of the tests can actually determine which type you have if it's positive. Other tests are just plus minus. You either have high risk or you don't. And in our country, we're in a transition right now. There's still 20% of our country that doesn't have the lab capacity to do high-risk HPV testing. And so they're relying still on Pap smear, but the recommendations are to try to move toward HPV testing because it picks up more abnormalities and it picks them up earlier. And many countries around the world, like Australia, Europe, Canada, have all moved to HPV screening over Pap smear.
Wow, and it sounds like it's less invasive than
Much
a
less invasive. And the good news, the really good news, is that you can actually collect your own swab. It's called self-sampling for HPV, where you can actually do a test, place the swab in your vagina and place it in a container, and then that swab itself can be tested. So that is happening also globally. In our country, it's been FDA approved to use in a clinic setting, but in a lot of settings, it's what's being used. For instance, you could go to rural areas or you could go to populations that have trouble getting into clinics and get the swabs there. Or you can have a woman who's been, traumatized and doesn't want to have a speculum placed in her vagina for various reasons, to do her own swab, which is what we offer in our clinic currently. And so I feel like it will be a wonderful improvement in access.
So it's kind of surprising to me that the HPV screening, you say, is more accurate than a Pap smear, even though it should be a lot less expensive to do. It doesn't require maybe the same level of time and training, time with the patient and training of the provider. But the fact that you have one of these high-risk HPVs doesn't mean that you have precancer.
Right. And thank you for saying that. That's like a key point. And I think one of the challenges in messaging about this screening method is if you have high-risk HPV, you know, it depends on what type you have and how long you've had it, as to what the follow-up recommendations would be, and whether you or not you need this closer look at your cervix, this colposcopy. But the key is that follow-up. And that isn't easy, right? You have to communicate that. You have to have the infrastructure to have that available. You have to have the funding mechanism to have that available. And typically, if it's a high-risk type, we say follow up in a year if it's your first abnormal screen, unless it's type 16 or 18, in which case we often look more closely right away for a colposcopy.
Okay. So it's a little scary if it's one of the tests that doesn't tell you what type.
Right.
Because if you wait a year, that might be too long.
Well, and there are only three types. It gets very confusing, but there's only three left. Only three lab tests that are approved for this primary HPV screening, and all of three of those lab tests can tell you which type.
Oh, okay. Okay.
Yeah.
All right. So where is the dividing line between, I know that the precancerous, at least used to be called dysplasia. I don't know if that's still the term that's used, but, the dividing line between like severe dysplasia and cancer.
Yeah, the dividing line essentially is have the cells left the surface of the cervix and invaded into the tissue itself of the cervix.
Okay.
And that is what changes it from precancer to invasive cancer. That typically can only be found out by biopsy.
Now, are there other forms of cancer where precancer is diagnosed, or is this the only one?
No. Anal cancer is diagnosed with precancer. Vulvar cancer is diagnosed by precancer. And so there are several different types of cancers. I mean, skin cancer, it can be precancer or invasive cancer.
Right.
It's typically just a marker of how far the abnormal cells have gotten into your body, and have they broken some kind of barrier or membrane and invaded tissue that is beyond just the surface.
Okay. You're listening to Writer's Voices, and our guest today is Dr. Linda Eckert, author of Enough, Because We Can Stop Cervical Cancer. So there's a lot of places where things aren't being done as much as they can, but there are also countries in the world that are really having success in reducing and stopping cervical cancer. The numbers of cervical cancer, according to the book, the deaths from the cases and the deaths have not been going down overall when they could have been. But share with us some of the places where they are going down and that have been successful, and how did that happen?
You know, and I think that's such a good point, because I feel like a lot of times we feel like we're doomed and cancer is hopeless, but this is not a hopeless cancer. This is actually a hopeful cancer. So Australia started vaccinating their youth and offering up to 26 in 2007 with the HPV vaccine. And they got very high acceptance, and they did it in schools. And the first few years they rolled it out, they got over 80% of their individuals vaccinated in the teen population, and up to 60% of their adult women up to age 26. At the same time, they also have really good screening. And so Australia is probably the first country that is predicted to eliminate cervical cancer. And they're expecting by 2040 to eliminate it. And the interesting thing also about Australia is, you know, not unlike any country, they have areas where it's very hard to have to reach, like in their Aboriginal population or their Indigenous population. And also what Australia did was that, we have equity issues. We need to address this population. We need to do it in ways that works for this population. We need to get this population involved and help us as the medical societies understand what are the best ways to work with them, what is the best messaging, et cetera. So they invested money, they invested people, they invested resources in that. And they really changed the narrative for how little screening was going on in their Aboriginal population. So they had this whole country approach. And it's worked exceedingly well. So they are the first continent country to eliminate cervical cancer, probably. Sweden is well on their way. There was just a major New England Journal article out a year ago about the impact of HPV vaccination and screening in Sweden, and how they are coming down, down, down in their cases. Switzerland is doing well. There are a lot of places around the world. And actually, Rwanda is the low resource setting. Wonderful success story. And again, they started HPV vaccination, I think in the early teens, very high coverage, like 90% coverage of HPV vaccine in their teenagers. And they are seeing their precancer rates fall markedly. So they will probably be the first country in Africa to eliminate cervical cancer.
So let's talk a little bit about the vaccine. You mentioned that. Well, first, the first question is, you have to receive the vaccine before you have been exposed to HPV in order for it to have effect. Is that true?
Right. It is what we call a preventive vaccine and not a treatment vaccine. So it prevents HPV infections against the types that are that protected against in the vaccine at a very high level. Like, this is a crazy effective vaccine. It's like 99% effective against preventing new infections with HPV 16 if you get it into your body before you're exposed to HPV 16. We don't have vaccines that are 99% effective. So, I mean, this is crazy how good this vaccine works. But yes, you want to get it in ideally before you're exposed to the virus types. And the thing about the HPV vaccine that we use in this country is it protects against seven types of HPV that can cause cancer, including 16 and 18, the two most dangerous. But even let's say you have a virus infection with HPV 18 and you have precancer, and then you get that treated, we still give the vaccine because it's going to protect against the other types that you may not have been exposed to yet.
Well, that's what I was going to ask because it seems like nobody over a certain age is allowed to get this vaccine. But like, for example, the shingles vaccine, I had shingles and then I got the vaccine so I wouldn't get shingles again, or
Right.
hopefully won't get shingles again. You know, it's not
Right.
100% effective. But but this is a little different. It won't protect against one that you've already had. Or what if you have your body's cleared the HPV. So if you don't have HPV right now, will the vaccine, even if you've had it in the past, will the vaccine protect you?
Yeah, and that is a really good question. The data we have on that suggests that there might be a decrease in your recurrence risk, but we still don't think of it as a really treating the infection as much as preventing. The reason the age range goes up to 45 are two. Number one, that was the oldest person in clinical trials in our country. And so really a vaccine can only be licensed in the age group that it's been tried in. And also HPV virus, when you acquire a new infection, takes many, many years to turn into cervical cancer, which is why screening works so well and finding abnormal cells can work so well. And so if you acquire a new infection when you're 50, the odds of developing cervical cancer from that are much, much less than if you acquire a new infection when you're 25. And so if you're a
Okay,
public.
so is that why they don't even recommend Pap smears past age 65?
Right.
Okay.
Yeah. Because the amount of new infections and developing cervical cancer after the age of 65 is very low. So, yeah, so that's why we use the vaccine to prevent new infections. The most people get their infections that cause cervical cancer in their late teens to early 20s. It takes usually 10 to 15 years to turn into cancer, which is why Pap smear screening or screening for HPV can be so effective because you can find it in its precancer stage and get rid of it. And so these are all reasons why we really try to give the vaccine younger. But the other reason that I think doesn't get talked about enough is that you get a better antibody response from 9 to 14. I mean, I hate to say it as a woman also who's been on this earth for a while, but our antibodies respond less well to vaccines as we age. And between 9 and 14, you can give fewer doses. We only give two doses in this country, and over 15, we give three doses. And so it's not just because you want to get people to get the vaccine before they get exposed to HPV. That's one reason. But the other reason is that you get a better immune response and you can use less doses. Nobody likes to get more shots.
Yeah, no kidding. And I read in your book that they're even experimenting with single dose and how
Right.
effective that is.
Yeah, we're talking about that right now in the US ACIP, which offers recommendations for vaccines in our country. But many countries, 63 countries globally, have moved to using a single dose of the vaccine in people under the age of 14.
So you also mentioned that ideally both males and females would be vaccinated because most females, if they get HPV, they're getting it from a male. So if the male
Right.
doesn't have it, they're not going to get it. Plus, he has some risk of various cancers from it as well, although much lower. However, there's a global shortage of the vaccine, and so that kind of changes your perspective on vaccinating males.
Well, and I think especially in the context of a global shortage, I mean, let's just say equity-wise, of course, all males and females, I want to have access to this vaccine. And in high-income countries that pay full price for the vaccine to the manufacturers, they don't have trouble getting enough supply to vaccinate their males and females. In lower-income countries that have negotiated lower rates, the WHO still recommends that the priority population be females because they are the ones that bear the biggest burden with cervical cancer being HPV caused. And if you vaccinate 80% of females, Australia showed this, you actually protect the males, most males, because you wipe out herd immunity, you wipe out the transmission of the virus. Now, of course, I want males to get vaccinated too. I vaccinated my sons when they were teenagers, as soon as it was approved in this country for males. But the current situation is that we still have trouble with everybody accessing enough vaccine, especially when they're not paying full price. That is getting better. We have more vaccine becoming available because there's been WHO approved vaccines now, two in China. Made in China, one on its way in India. And as we get more and more supply, then of course it'll be easier to vaccinate everybody under the age of 15 to 20, depending on your country, and also to include males. And also it'll really drop the price. So that will be great news for all of those reasons.
Oh, yeah. I was wondering why there was a shortage, and I wondered if the COVID vaccine, the demand for that, if that was part of why there was a shortage of the HPV vaccine.
I think that certainly sidetracked the India company, Serum Institute, that makes a lot of vaccines. And they have been working on their HPV vaccine for a while. And I know they changed their attention to COVID vaccines during that time.
Yeah.
So I think it definitely slowed things down.
Wow. So when it comes to vaccination, there's, why wouldn't everybody get vaccinated who could?
Well, you're talking to a person who makes everything good, right? So, yeah, I feel like with any public health program or any intervention, there's an opportunity for misunderstanding, misinformation, even purposeful disinformation sometimes can be either politically or whatever motivated. So I feel like this vaccine, because especially it targets a body part that is, you know, not
talked about,
not mentioned. It targets a virus that is transferred most commonly by intimate contact. I would say digital contact can spread HPV virus as well. It's just not as efficient as penetration. But and then also because we were vaccinating people in their preteens when we don't want to talk about sex, you know, this whole thing got really turned into a political football instead of talking about a cancer-causing virus that we could prevent. And what parent doesn't want to protect their kid from cancer? It became this discussion about, oh, is this a behavior vaccine? If we give this vaccine, will people change their behaviors? And all of a sudden, will our girls think that they can have more sex and have more partners? And so it became this big religious and political.
Which is so foolish. It's like no 15, 16, 17, 18-year-old girl is thinking, I'm not going to have sex because I might get cervical cancer. And so now, since I can't get cervical cancer, I'm going to have sex. Nobody's thinking that.
Well, and it's also interesting that that line of thinking is only directed toward the girls, right? People aren't worried about the boys' behavior nearly so much. But, you know, so there were a lot of religious organizations in our country, Focus on the Family, came out against this vaccine in their original position paper in 2007, that wasn't changed until 2019. The Catholic Medical Association was not very in favor of this. I talk about this a lot in my book. Actually, the Bush administration put money into researching whether behavior changed because of this vaccine, actually. And that was some of the initial funded research that showed it does not lead to increased number of partners or increase, you know, or a lower age of sexual debut. And actually that research has been done in Uganda. It's been done in Brazil. It's been done in Europe. It's been done in Latin America. So there's been all kinds of research all over the world, Australia, that has shown that getting the HPV vaccine does not change sexual behavior, but it remains a very common fear. And I think that that combined with the difficulty parents have talking about sex with their kids or wanting to or so forth has made it a lot harder to get wide uptake of this vaccine.
You're listening to Writers' Voices, and our guest today is Dr. Linda Eckert, author of Enough, Because We Can Stop Cervical Cancer. Another topic that you deal with a lot in the book. Oh, actually, let's circle back to that screening for 50 to 65-year-olds you mentioned was important.
Well, thank you, because I think in our country, what we see is that when women in having their periods, they often end going to their gynecologist and they go to their primary care doctor, and they don't always want to get a pap smear from their primary care doctor, or they don't always want to get screened, or there's not enough time, et cetera. And one of the more underscreened populations in our country is 50 to 60 year old women. And because of that, we actually have 20% of cervical cancer in our country diagnosed in women 60 and above. And it's because they're not getting screened for precancer, you know, after menopause as much. And this is seen actually globally, too. It's seen in Canada. It's seen in England. Like, there's a real drop off of screening once people quit having their periods. And I think that, too, is something I really hope self-swabbing with HPV will end, you know. And then currently in our country, it's recommended you can stop cervical cancer screening at 65, but it's only if you've had either two negative HPV tests in a row or three negative pap smears in a row, and only if you haven't been treated for precancer in the previous 25 years. So I think people think 65, I can stop, but there are these caveats of being able to stop that's really important to consider. And sure, if you meet those caveats, then stop.
Yeah.
Otherwise, don't, you know, do the right thing and get screening.
Okay. That's important. So you talk a lot in the book about particularly in what would you say developing countries, but also in more prosperous countries too, the stigma that can accompany a diagnosis of cervical cancer and how that prevents people from getting seeking treatment.
Yeah, I think that, as a gynecologist, I would say in general, women bear the shame of any sexually transmitted infection more than men. But with cervical cancer, especially before people had good understanding of HPV and how common it was, and even now, because not everybody understands that. Many of the women I interviewed for this book talked about their good friends saying, "Oh, you had too many partners," or "You had sex too young," or, "What did you do wrong to get this cancer?" And that it really carries a heavy stigmatized burden. And I think that's true whether you are a Google executive in this country or whether you are in Zimbabwe. When I was, talking to women, I was actually so struck by the burden of shame that comes, continues to come with cervical cancer.
And so some of these women who basically said, I don't care, I'm going to talk about it. They're so brave.
I think there are many ways this book changed me. And one of the ways that it changed me, even as a lifetime gynecologist that I think has a decent amount of empathy, was to realize the courage and the resilience that it takes to live with cancer. And then the willingness that women had, these women that were willing to tell me, a perfect stranger, usually their story, to put in a book, they are so compelled because they don't want other people to suffer the suffering they've had. And they just really want to get their message out there and they want people to know about this so that there can really be fewer people that have to go through cervical cancer diagnosis and treatment and life after treatment.
Do you want to talk a little bit about the treatment and the effects of the treatments?
Yeah, I think, our future health secretary, I mean, the votes today, I assume he's going to pass, mentioned that, oh, cervical cancer is easy to treat. We don't need to worry about it. I would encourage people to read the stories in this book. That I agree with you. I think the stories are the most compelling and humanizing part. But if cancer is found early and it's just diagnosed at the cervix and hasn't spread, yes, the cure rate is very high. It's like 95%. But almost all of the treatments will leave you sterile. So I had women, 25 years old who had their uteruses removed or radiation damage. And radiation, even when you, so the first treatment could be surgery, could be a radical hysterectomy with removal of your lymph nodes. If it's found super, super early, sometimes you can just remove part of the cervix and not have to remove the whole uterus, but that's very uncommon. And so you can have surgery. The other thing that happens if the tumor is more than 4 to 5 centimeters in the, even if it's just on the cervix, is radiation. That radiation can be externally where you have the radiation beams coming in from outside your body, or what's called internal radiation, which is where you have equipment placed in your vagina that holds radiation right up against your cervix and those tissues. That's called brachytherapy. Again, those are very successful for curing the cancer and helping it not kill you. But the number of complications people have from radiation is really significant. That you can imagine that when you put radiation in your vaginal tissue, it's not good for your vaginal tissue. And as a gynecologist, I dealt with a lot of women who might be 15 years out from their surgery, but were having such difficulty with painful intercourse or scarring or shortening of their vaginas and so forth as those long-term radiation. Or there's stories in my book of books, women who have bowel damage and bladder damage to their intestines and their bladder, or they have early menopause because they had their ovaries radiated and they're now 30, 35 and they're going through menopause. And so the long-term consequences of this treatment are life-changing.
Wow. Linda, why don't you read a little bit from Enough?
Okay, I am going to read a story about a woman and the HPV vaccine, because I think that that is going to be a subject that we hear more and more about in our country right now. And the way the book is set up is that each chapter has at least one, if not several, stories, either from my own career or from people who chose to give me their stories. And around that story, it wraps information written for the general public. And this is a chapter that's called Sex, Lies, and Logistics: Obstacles to Vaccination Beyond the Marketplace. Okay, so this section is called Good Information and Lots of It. Countering misinformation based on fear, suspicion, and sensationalist reporting requires excellent and relentless public health messaging. Governments and healthcare systems at all levels must not only fight bad information, but supply good information, lots of it, all the time. This expenditure of time, money, and energy demands public and civic will built on valuing women's health. Morgan was one of these people who needed more good information. She was an upbeat, glass-half-full dental office manager from Des Moines, Iowa. Morgan was completely unprepared when her doctor said, "Morgan, I'm sorry, but you have cervical cancer." She was 24. And no, that is not a typo. Morgan was diagnosed with cervical cancer at 24. Morgan received her unexpected diagnosis despite, for the most part, doing everything right. In particular, she'd been getting screened for cervical cancer in accordance with recommended guidelines. Morgan had gone to a local Planned Parenthood clinic to have her first pap smear at 21, and received normal test results. 3 years later, in keeping with recommended screening intervals, she returned for her next pap test, only to receive an abnormal result. After a follow-up and biopsies, she was sent to a gynecology oncologist on February 4th, 2015, and she keenly recalls the date. "I hardly remember anything he said after those three words, 'You have cancer.' I do remember the box of Kleenex in the conference room, and boy, did I use them." I was stunned to hear the age of Morgan's diagnosis, half the average age, which usually is diagnosed at 50. Along with her cancer progression, she was diagnosed as stage 3B. Cervical cancer this advanced at such a young age is practically unheard of. The radiation and chemotherapy treatments were aggressive and grueling, causing a series of dangerous bowel obstructions. Her cancer recurred a year later, this time in her lung, but further chemotherapy gave her long-term remission. And since then, Morgan has been living cancer-free, calling herself blessed. "My doctor said only 3 to 5% of people with my advanced stage of cancer who suffer lung recurrence are cured," she said. "This time, I am thrilled to be rare." But none of these circumstances had to happen. Morgan was 14 the year the HPV vaccine was introduced in the United States. Had she opted for the vaccine then, Morgan could have avoided her diagnosis altogether. Instead, she became part of the majority. The 83% of teens who did not receive HPV vaccination during its first year of availability, either because they were not offered the vaccine or they opted out. "I didn't know a whole lot about it," she recalled during our face-to-face interview. "I remember telling my mom, 'No, I don't want that vaccine.'" And then she paused as if to consider the weight of her statement. "To this day, if you were to ask my mom, she regrets ever letting me make that decision." But Morgan blames neither her mom nor herself for refusing a vaccine 99% effective in preventing the HPV 16 strain. "I don't think I understood the connection between HPV and cancer and the vaccine." And she shook her head ever so slightly, looking away. "And well," she continued ruefully, "I said those famous last words about cancer that all people say. That'll never happen." And then 10 years later, it happened. It happened to me. HPV 16. My cancer was caused by HPV 16. We both were silent. It felt like a moment of silence to acknowledge a death. The death of her fertility, the death of her normal bladder and bowel function, the death of what she called her lightness of being, all now irreversibly gone, while Morgan was still not yet 30. And while she moved forward, a testament to her resilience, I pondered just how different Morgan's life could have been with a robust public health campaign had there been simply enough good information. Yes, Morgan agreed. I now love telling everyone I can just how important it is to get this vaccine.
That was Dr. Linda Eckert reading from Enough, Because We Can Stop Cervical Cancer. Do you want to share maybe one other story of women, you know, not necessarily read it, but just talk about one of the other women that you feature in the book?
I think, let's see. One of the stories that really hits home to me, the inequity, is a woman, Kim, who worked in Haiti. And when she was working in Haiti, she became really good friends with a Haitian woman. Their children played together all the time. And when Kim came, and there's a picture of them actually together in the book, Elvia, the Haitian woman, and Elvia's children and Kim. And then when Kim came back to the United States, you know, she had six kids. She realized that she was behind on her pap smear. She went to get her pap smear. I mean, after all, women don't take care of themselves. They always take care of their kids and their families first. And when she got her pap smear, she had an abnormal result. And within 18 days, she had a cancer diagnosis and she was starting treatment for cervical cancer. And she had a really grueling treatment. She had several challenges also with radiation and diarrhea and losing control of her bowels, et cetera. But she was cured. And what she came to find out was that at the time they had this picture taken in Haiti, Elvia also had cervical cancer that she didn't know about. But Elvia was not able to access any treatment. Because in Haiti, still, they don't have any radiation machines. That's the way it is in a lot of the world. And so Elvia died 6 months after her diagnosis and left behind her 9 and 11-year-old children. And Kim keeps the picture of she and Elvia and Elvia's children every night and says, you know, talks about, I was able to access treatment because I live in a high resource setting and I have insurance. But so many people, both in this country and globally, that's not the case. And the inequity of this disease is so striking. And so she's become an advocate and speaking out because of having experienced this inequity of her good friend and her, unbeknownst to both of them, having this picture taken when they both had cervical cancer.
So, Linda, in addition to, you know, a listener making sure that they or their loved ones get screening, and that the young people in their lives get vaccinated. What are some things that people can do to help stop cervical cancer worldwide?
Yeah, I appreciate that. I think, you know, I think in our country, we still have a big challenge with access that's being unequal in areas, especially that didn't expand Medicaid in states. Low-cost screening is hard to come by because so many clinics, Planned Parenthoods, et cetera, have been closed. And so I think advocating, for instance, for cervical cancer screening funding and for vaccination funding is something that we can do. I think globally, you know, it's a big crisis right now. I have to admit, I have shed a lot of tears in the last 3 weeks because the funding of cervical cancer screening globally is through PEPFAR, most of it in Africa. And programs that many colleagues I know in Namibia, Malawi, Uganda, so forth, have been shut in the last 2 weeks. So We had 250 people in Namibia trained to do screening. They had 25 LEAP machines in their country. They'd gone from zero screening to screening 50,000 people last year in just a few years. This incredible program shut in 2 weeks. And so I think, again, advocating for the fact that this is a preventable cancer, that women everywhere, I don't care who they are, contribute immensely to their economies, to their communities. The WHO has calculated for every dollar spent on screening for cervical cancer, it returns $26 back to the economy because you keep women healthy, you keep them in the workforce, and also all the work they do for their communities and caring for elders and caring for other people and taking food to their neighbors, et cetera. So it's a 26-to-1 ratio. And if you want to talk about efficient use of money, that is incredible. So I do think it's a time to continue to speak out. I'm calling today. So.
Oh, good for you. Good for you. People need to realize that their vote actually, they might be voting to kill women in other countries, basically.
Well, I think so many people don't even understand what USAID is or what PEPFAR is, and they think of it as just, HIV care, but it's not, it's way beyond that. I mean, it's that too.
Yeah,
And
plus not that the HIV victims of HIV don't deserve care too.
exactly.
They do.
Yeah. So I think that, I think that we have made a lot of strides in cervical cancer prevention, and we know how to do it. It's not like we need more basic science research. We need implementation of what we know how to do. And so I
And that
think,
takes money.
and that takes money, and it takes political will, and it takes valuing women. I think this is really a question about how much are you going to value women. And you can make the economic argument like I just did, and you can also make the humanitarian argument, about we know what happens to families when mothers die. The children don't finish school, they have less health, they get less education, they are more impoverished because you've lost a work person in the family, and it creates this generational trauma and generational poverty that is preventable.
So, Linda, I want to talk to you in our last few minutes about the writing of your book. So, you decided you were going to write this book. What was your first step? What did you do? Because you're a doctor, you're not a writer.
And isn't that the truth? Oh my gosh. It's a good thing I was really naive as to how hard it would take to write a book. I really decided that I felt like these women's voices needed to be out there and become the centerpiece of discussion about this cancer. So I had medical contacts around the world because I've worked with World Health Organization and other places. And I have worked in Kenya. I've worked in various places. So I was going to go around and get interviews, but then COVID hit. I had taken a year of 2020 off without pay from work so I could collect stories and do all the interviews. And so, because of COVID hitting, then I needed to reach out via survivor networks or Zoom. And so I reached out, and in 2020, I really focused on getting interviews. I interviewed, over 35 women with cervical cancer from six continents, some with the help of interpreters. And again, some of the stories are my own experiences over the year. I interviewed a lot of experts from many different continents, et cetera. And so by the end of 2020, I also had hired a book coach to help me really, I'd written guidelines, I'd written papers, all this stuff, but to string together an arc and use non-medical terms. So I had this wonderful book coach who knew nothing about HPV or science. So everything she read, if it was jargony, she could tell me. And so by the end of 2020, I had a draft, but it was 120,000 words, which is way too long. And so I
Whoa.
spent the next 2 years whittling away. And then after that, wrote a book proposal, found an agent, which I got rejected 19 times before I got 20 to find an agent. And then we actually crafted the book proposal more carefully because Roe v. Wade had been overturned. And we started it out as like, women are angry, but here's something we can do something about. this preventable cancer. And so I solicited publishing companies, and I got rejected by like 45. And so it was about a year process between getting an agent and getting a publisher and then getting a contract. And then after I got another contract, it was another roughly 9 months through all the editing and everything with a publisher till the final book came out. So that whole process from inception to interviews and so forth was about 3.5 to 4 years.
And your publisher is Cambridge University Press, which is very, what would you say, prestigious. So,
yes, they're the oldest publishing company in the world. They were started in 1560.
Wow.
Yeah, they're the first publishing company.
And how, why did they say yes when it, when you had so many rejections?
You know, I think because they have a different remit. Part of their, you know, part of their remit is more toward textbooks and academic information. They also have a big social justice component. And that was another reason. And the third thing is they were really looking to expand, not just from textbooks, but to nonfiction books that could cross between academics to lay population. And so this book really hit that because, you know, I'm had the good fortune to be able to teach in some courses, like I'm teaching in a reproductive justice course at the University of Michigan in 2 weeks, using cervical cancer as an example of reproductive injustice. But it also is written for the general public. And so it was a sweet spot that they were looking for to try to say, we don't want to just do textbooks. We want to move into the nonfiction world with information that is digestible by anybody who picks up the book about an important topic that people can do something about. And that I think centering it on the stories was also a unique take.
Now, when was the book published? When did it come out?
It came out in January of 2024.
Okay. So you've been, you've had it out for over a year now. Yeah. What kind of response have you gotten?
So it's been an interesting ride. You know, marketing a book is not something an OBGYN in medical school.
They don't teach you that, huh?
No, they don't teach you that. So, I've used my academic credentials to talk a lot about cervical cancer and the injustice of it and also the equity challenges in our country, which I think a lot of people don't know. I would say that this book isn't geared, though, for the medical profession. It's really geared for the general public. And so I think that I'm continuing to work to get out into general public audiences. I really see this as a book club book. So I want to work on writing a book club guide for it. And I see this as a way for, especially now, I think we're going to, as the general public, we really need to figure out ways to arm ourselves with accurate information.
Yeah.
And so I really see this as a book that anyone could pick up and read and get some understanding about a problem, you know, HPV associated cancers, and also about the vaccine, but also then the stories are just so, they've inspired me. They, knowing these women has changed me.
Wow. Well, I will say I've learned a lot from reading this book. So I want to thank you, Dr. Eckert.
Thank you.
And we're running out of time. So I want to thank you so much for being with us today. My closing quote today is from Michelle Obama. Communities and countries and ultimately the world are only as strong as the health of their women.
Yeah, thank you for that quote. May we remember that.
Yes, yep. And see you all next week on Writers' Voices.